No, I'm not the one for this job, to pose like that with this woman. I can't. No one will know. I won't show your face. And this woman, don't you want to meet her? Wouldn't you like to be part of the inspiration for such a piece? After being given just the one night to think it over, Jay had called the next morning and agreed to be the model. Of course, there was no way the younger man could guess what he really wanted, to film the two of them, Jay and his sister-in-law, actually having sex. "She's a bit late, isn't she?" Jay asked, peering nervously out of the window. He'd already been growing impatient himself. She'd assured him that she'd be able to find the place on her own, so he decided to wait for her at the studio rather than meeting at the underground station. "Well, perhaps I'll go down to the station." He picked up his sweater and stood up, but just then they heard someone knocking on the translucent glass door. "Ah, here she is." Jay put down his cup of coffee. This time she was wearing a chunky black sweater with the same jeans as before. Her loose hair, naturally very black, was still wet. She must have washed it just before she came out. She looked first at him, then at Jay, then gave a quick laugh. "I was very careful," she said, touching her hair. "I didn't get any water on the flowers." Jay smiled, looking relieved. He probably hadn't expected her to seem so ordinary. "Take off your clothes." "Me?" Jay's eyes opened wide. "She's already been painted, so now I just have to do you." Stifling a nervous giggle, Jay turned his back on them and got undressed. "You'll have to take your pants off, too." Jay hesitated, then did as he was asked. Jay's body was slight, more so than he'd expected. Aside from the thick hair that ran down in a line from his belly button and spread to the tops of his thighs, his flesh was enviably white and smooth. Just as he'd done with his sister-in-law, he had Jay lie prone and began to paint him with flowers, starting from the nape of his neck. Working as quickly as possible, he used a big brush to paint light purple hydrangeas, which seemed to tumble down over Jay's back, as though caught in a strong wind. "Turn over." Using Jay's penis as the center, he painted a single huge flower, the crimson of blood, so that it looked as though Jay's black pubic hair was the sepals and his penis the pistol. She sat quietly on the sofa all the while, sipping a cup of tea and carefully watching him work. When he was done, he noticed that Jay's penis had stiffened slightly. After painting the rest of the flowers on Jay's torso, he took a quick breather, then stood up and replaced the tape in the camcorder with a new one, wanting to make sure there would be plenty of running time. He turned to her and asked her to take her clothes off. She did as he asked. The light wasn't as strong as it had been the last time, but the golden cluster of flowers that he'd painted right in the center of her chest still sparkled brilliantly. In contrast to Jay, she was perfectly composed, as if declaring how much more natural it was to not wear clothes. When she knelt down on the sheet, the entranced look on Jay's face didn't escape him. Without his giving her any directions, she moved closer to Jay, and he, as though mirroring her, got into a kneeling position. There was something desolate in the contrast between her still, silent face and her radiant body. "What should we do now?" Jay asked, his face red. He was probably nervous at the prospect of having to take the lead. All the same, his penis had stiffened again. "Sit her on your knees." He thought it best to refer to her as simply her. Now he picked up the camcorder and approached them. "Pull her close." "Damn it! Haven't you ever done this before? You're supposed to be acting. Try touching her breasts or something." Jay wiped his forehead with the back of his hand. But before he could do anything, she slowly maneuvered around to face and then straddle him. She slid her hand behind Jay's neck and drew him toward her, while her other hand began to stroke the red flower on his chest. Marked with nothing but the breathing of the three people, an amount of time passed that would be impossible to measure. Jay's nipples quietly hardened and his penis became erect. She rubbed her neck against Jay's like they were two birds caressing, almost as if she'd seen his sketches and knew exactly what he wanted her to do. "Good. Really good." He filmed the scene from several angles, eventually finding the best one. "Good. Keep going. Lie down like that, on top of each other." She put her hand on Jay's chest and gently pushed him down onto the sheet, then reached out and began to stroke the red flowers that led down over Jay's torso, taking them one by one and slowly making her way toward his crotch. He moved behind her with the camcorder, making sure to capture the dark purple flowers scattered over her back, the Mongolian mark rippling in time with her movements. He clenched his teeth and thought to himself, this is it. Now if only it could be even better. Jay's penis was already fully erect, and he was grimacing as though he couldn't bear the pressure any longer. She slowly lay down on her stomach, her breasts resting on Jay's chest, and her buttocks lifting up into the space above them. He filmed the two of them side-on. There was something obscene about the way her back was arched like a cat's, about the unpainted space around Jay's belly button, about his rigid penis. They were almost like two huge abstracted plants. When she slowly sat up straight, straddling Jay's hips, he stammered. Perhaps... I mean, I was just thinking. He looked at her and Jay in turn. Could you maybe do it, you know, for real? There was no flicker of shock or revulsion in her face, but Jay suddenly pushed her away as though her skin were burning him. He got to his knees, awkwardly trying to conceal his penis. What? You want to make some kind of a porno? If you don't feel like it, that's fine. But if it were possible for you to just naturally... That's it, I'm done. Jay stood up. Just a minute, wait. I won't ask you to do anything more, just what you've been doing so far. He grabbed Jay by the shoulder. Perhaps he'd used more force than he'd intended, because Jay grunted and pushed his hand away. Hey, come on, there's no need for that. A silent pause. Jay seemed to soften a little. I understand. I'm an artist too, after all. But this kind of thing just... No. Who is this woman anyway? She doesn't seem like a prostitute, and even if she were, it still wouldn't be okay, you know? I understand. Really, I do. I'm sorry. Jay got back onto the sheet, but the sexually charged atmosphere of a few minutes ago had completely fizzled out. He put his arms around her and laid her down. His face set hard as though this were all some form of punishment. Their bodies overlapped like two petals, and she closed her eyes. If Jay had agreed, she would have gone along without a murmur of protest. He felt sure of that. Try moving a bit. Slowly, Jay moved his body back and forth in a pained, stilted mimicry of sex. He watched as the soles of her feet curled up and her hands clasped Jay's waist. Her body was sufficiently animated, flushed with desire, to make up for Jay's passivity. They spent 10 minutes or so in that position, every second of which was clearly repulsive to Jay, though to him it felt all too short. Still, he managed to get the angles he'd wanted and some decent images for the tape. Are we all done now? Jay asked. His skin was flushed red right up to his hair, but it wasn't from arousal. Just once more. This is the last time. He swallowed. From behind. Make her lie on her stomach. This really is the last time. It's the most important scene. Don't say you can't. Jay burst into a laughter that sounded more like sobbing. That's it. That's really it. I'm going to stop now before this gets any worse. You've got plenty of inspiration. Now I know what it feels like for porno actors. It's miserable. He put a restraining hand on Jay's shoulder, but Jay shook him off and began to get dressed. He gritted his teeth and watched as his work, the still intact whirl of flowers, disappeared beneath Jay's plain-colored shirt. It's not that I don't understand, okay? Don't think I'm some kind of prude. I guess I'm just more restrained than I thought I was. I agreed to do it because I was curious, but I just can't go through with it. I guess there are just parts of myself that I need to awaken, but I need some time first. I'm sorry. Jay was evidently sincere and seemed hurt more than anything else. The young man bowed to him, giving only a cursory glance over in her direction, then walked briskly to the door. I'm sorry, he said as Jay's car roared out of the front yard. She didn't reply, just put on her sweater and stepped into her jeans. But then, instead of zipping them up, she just giggled into the air. Why are you laughing? Because I'm all wet. He looked over at her, feeling as dazed as though he just received a blow to the head. She had her hand on the half-up zipper and was hesitating, looking as though she couldn't bring herself to pull it either up or down. Only then did he realize that he was still holding the camcorder. He set it down, strode over to the door which Jay had left open, and locked it. Just in case, he put the upper security chain on too. Walking over almost at a run, he clutched her to him, and the two of them tumbled down onto the sheet. When he tugged her jeans down to her knees, she said, "No." It wasn't just verbally that she rejected him. She shoved him away roughly, stood up, and pulled her jeans back up. He watched as she did up the zipper and fastened the button. He stood up, stepped closer to her, and pushed her still fevered body up against the wall. But when he pressed his lips firmly against hers, probing with his tongue, she shoved him away again. "Why shouldn't we? Because I'm your brother-in-law?" "No, it's nothing to do with that."
"Then why not? Come on, you said you were all wet."
She was silent.
"Did you fancy that kid?"
"It wasn't him. It was the flowers."
"The flowers?"
Her face instantly blanched, as if in fear. Her lower lip, red and swollen from wearing it with her teeth, trembled imperceptibly.
"I really wanted to do it," she said carefully. "I've never wanted it so much before. It was the flowers on his body. I couldn't help myself. That's all."
He watched as she turned her back on him and walked decisively over to the door. As she scrunched her feet into her trainers, he shouted over to her,
"If—"
He couldn't keep a shrill note from his voice.
"If I painted flowers on myself, would you do it then?"
She turned around and stared back at him, and he understood her gaze to be one of complicity.
"And I could film it?"
She laughed. Faintly, as if there were nothing she wouldn't do, as if limits and boundaries no longer held any meaning for her, or else, as if in quiet mockery. "I wish I were dead. I wish I were dead. So die." Unable to understand why the tears were streaming down his face, he clutched the steering wheel and set the wipers to frequent, only to realize that it wasn't the windshield that was blurred, but his own vision. He couldn't understand why the words, "I wish I were dead," were ceaselessly being hammered out inside his head like an incantation. Nor could he understand why the words, "So die," would inevitably follow, as though the response were coming from someone inside him, and yet not him. And he couldn't understand how that simple mantra, like a conversation between two strangers, could be sufficient to calm his shuddering body. He lowered the windows all the way down, on both the driver's side and the passenger's. The car raced along the dark highway amid the roar of the wind and the nighttime traffic. The trembling started in his hands and then spread through his whole body, so he gritted his teeth and pressed down on the accelerator. Every time he glanced at the speedometer, he was shocked by how fast he was going and rubbed his eyes with shaking fingers. Wearing a white cardigan over a black dress, P walked up to the main gate of the apartment building. The two of them had dated for 4 years until she broke up with him. Later, she'd married one of her primary school classmates, who'd passed the bar examinations. Her husband was the main breadwinner, but she'd managed to successfully combine married life with her own work. She'd held several private exhibitions, becoming something of a name among the Gangnam collectors, which had of course provoked a flurry of jealous slander from those who knew her. P soon noticed the car, as he'd left the front and back emergency lights on. He drove down toward the gate and shouted,
"Get in!" "Anyone might recognize me here. Hell, even the porter knows my face. What on earth do you want at this time of night?" "Just get in. I've something to tell you."
P reluctantly did as he asked.
"It's been a while, I know. Sorry for calling you up out of the blue like that." "You're right, it has been a while. And this isn't like you. I don't believe you just had a sudden urge to see me again."
He rubbed his forehead impatiently. "I have a favor to ask."
"Go on."
"It's a long story. Let's go to your studio. Is it nearby?"
"Just a 5-minute walk." "But won't you tell me what's going on?"
P shouted at him, her strident tone demanding that he hurry up and give her a straight answer. She'd always been hot-tempered. He was suddenly glad of her vitality, of her strong character, which he had at one time found somewhat wearying. A sudden impulse to embrace her gripped him, then faded away as abruptly as it had come. Just the vague memory of an old emotion.
"It's a good thing my husband's working tonight," said P, switching on the studio lights. "Otherwise, there might have been one hell of a misunderstanding."
"Take a look at the sketches I mentioned." He held them out to her, and she gave them her full attention, an earnest expression on her face.
"Interesting. You know, I'm surprised. I didn't know you knew how to use color like this."
"So?" She rubbed her sagging jawline.
"This is quite an about turn. Could you really exhibit something like this? Your nickname used to be the May Priest, you know. After Gwangju, your art was so engagé, almost as though you were atoning for surviving the May Massacre. You seem so serious, so ascetic. All very romantic, I have to admit."
P peered at him closely over her glasses.
"I can see you're aiming to transform your image, but isn't this a little extreme? Of course, it isn't for me to argue the pros and cons."
Not wanting to get into a debate with P, he kept quiet and began to take off his clothes. P seemed a little surprised, but nevertheless resigned, as she mixed the paints in the palette and selected a brush.
"Well," she murmured, "it's certainly been a long time since I last saw you naked."
Slowly, painstakingly, P began to paint. The brush was cold, and the sensation was ticklish yet numbing, a persistent, effectual caress.
"I'll make sure my personal style doesn't come through. I mean, I like flowers too, so I've drawn plenty in my time, but yours have a distinctive energy about them. I'll bring your drawings to life."
It was well past midnight when P finally announced that she was finished.
"Thanks," he said, shivering from the cold. "If there was a mirror, I'd show it to you."
He looked down at his chest, stomach, and legs, all covered with goose pimples, and at the huge red flowers painted there.
"I like it. You're better at it than me. I'm not quite sure about how the backs turned out. In your sketches, it seemed like you'd put more emphasis on the back."
"I'm sure it's great, given your reputation, that is.
I tried to paint them the way you drew them, not how I choose to do it myself, but I guess I couldn't stop a little bit of myself coming through. I'm really grateful."
Only then did P laugh.
"Actually, when you took your clothes off, I got kind of turned on."
"Oh?" he remarked absentmindedly, hurriedly slipping his clothes on. He felt a little warmer with his sweater on, but his limbs were still stiff.
"Now, for some reason..."
"What?"
"It looks wrong, seeing you with your whole body covered in flowers. It feels kind of... pitiful. I never felt that way about you before."
P came over and finished buttoning up his shirt for him.
"I should at least get a kiss, seeing as you called me up in the middle of the night."
Before he'd had a chance to respond, P pressed her lips to his. The kiss was a palimpsest of memories, of all the countless kisses they shared in the past. He felt as though he were about to cry, but he couldn't tell whether it was because of happy memories, or friendship, or fear of the boundary he was intending soon to cross. It was late, so he knocked softly on the door rather than press the buzzer. Instead of waiting for an answer, he tried the handle. As he'd expected, the door opened. He stepped into the pitch-black living room. The glass door to the veranda let in the pale gleam from the streetlights, but it wasn't bright enough for him to be able to make out anything. His foot bumped against the shoe cupboard.
"Are you asleep?"
He set the filming equipment down by the front door. It was heavy, and he'd had to carry some of it slung over his shoulders as well as what he could carry in his hands. When he took off his shoes and moved over in the direction of the mattress, he could make out the faint outline of a person sitting there. Even in the darkness, he could still tell that she was naked. She got up and came toward him.
"Shall I turn on the light?"
His voice was hoarse with desire.
"You smell," she said in a low voice, "of paint."
He groaned and reached out for her, forgetting about the lighting, the camcorder, everything. None of that existed now. He laid her down with a snarl, clutching at her breasts with one hand and haphazardly sucking her lips and nose as he hurriedly unbuttoned his shirt.
He tugged at the lower buttons, tearing them off in his haste. As soon as he was naked, he pushed her legs wide apart and entered her. A constant panting sound, as if from a wild animal, was coming from somewhere, interspersed with a moaning that rose into an eerie shriek. When he realized that these noises were coming from him, he shuddered. He'd never made a sound during sex, had always thought of it as the preserve of flirtatious young women. Into her already soaking wet vagina, which was contracting alarmingly, he released a jet of semen with a gasp of pain, falling forward as though swooning. "I'm sorry," he said, reaching out for her face in the darkness. "Can I turn on the light?" she asked. She sounded perfectly composed. "What for?" "I want to be able to see you properly." She stood up and walked over to the switch. Their sex had been fairly one-sided and hadn't even lasted 5 minutes, so it was no wonder she didn't seem tired. When she flicked the lights on, he shaded his eyes from the sudden glare. He waited, blinking, until he was able to lower his hands. She was leaning against the wall. The flowers scattered over her body were as beautiful as ever. Suddenly self-conscious, he put his hands over his paunch and tried to suck it in. "Don't cover it. I like it. The petals look like they're wrinkled." She slowly came toward him. She bent over, and as she'd done with Jay, reached out and began to stroke the flowers on his chest. "Just a minute." Still naked, he stood up and went over to the front door, where he'd left the equipment. He set the tripod up, quite low, and fixed the camcorder in place, then pushed the mattress out onto the veranda and spread the white sheet, which he'd brought with him, out onto the floor. He set up the lighting just as it had been in M's studio. "Can you lie down?" Once she was lying down, he estimated where their entwined bodies would end up and adjusted the camcorder accordingly. She lay stretched out under the blinding spotlight. He carefully lowered himself on top of her. Would their bodies look like overlapping petals, as they had with her and Jay? Would they seem like one body, a hybrid of plant, animal, and human? Every time they changed position, he readjusted the camcorder. Before he took her from behind, which Jay had refused to do, he first took a long close-up of her buttocks. After he inserted himself, he checked how the image looked in the exterior monitor, then started to thrust. Everything was perfect. It was just like in his sketches. His red flower closed and opened repeatedly above her Mongolian mark, his penis slipping in and out of her like a huge pistol. He shuddered at the appalling nature of their union, a union of images that were somehow repellent and yet compellingly beautiful. Every time he closed his eyes, he could see the lower half of his body dyed green, soaked from the stomach to the thighs with a sticky, grassy sap. "Forever," he gasped. "All of this, forever," as an unendurable sense of satiation shuddered through his body and she burst into tears. She, who hadn't let slip a single moan in close to 30 minutes, whose lips had merely trembled at times, who had kept her eyes closed and communicated her keen ecstasy to him purely through the movements of her body. And now it had to end. He raised himself into a sitting position, still clasping her to him. He moved over to the camcorder, groped for the button, and switched it off. The image he'd wanted to capture on film had to be one that could be repeated over and over, forbidden either to end or to come to a climax. And so, this was where the filming had to stop. He waited until her sobs had subsided before laying her back down on the sheet. In their final minutes of sex, she gnashed her teeth, screamed rough and shrill, spat out a panting stop, and then, at the end, she cried again. And then everything grew quiet. In the dark blue light of dawn, he licked her buttocks for a long time. "I wish I could transfer it onto my tongue." "What?" "This Mongolian mark." She turned and looked at him over her shoulder, seeming surprised. "How come you've still got it?" "I don't know. I used to think everyone had them. But then I went to the public baths one day, and I saw that I was the only one." He held her at the waist and stroked the mark, wishing that he could share it with her, that it could be seared onto his skin like a brand. I want to swallow you, have you melt into me and flow through my veins. Will the dream stop now? She muttered, her voice barely audible. Dreams? Ah, the face. That's right. You said it was a face, no? He said, feeling drowsiness slowly creep through his body. What kind of face? Whose face? It's different every time. Sometimes it feels very familiar. Other times I'm sure I've never seen it before. There are times when it's all bloody, and times when it looks like the face of a rotting corpse. He looked her in the eye, his own eyes heavy with the effort of staying open. She, on the other hand, didn't look the least bit tired. Her eyes were agitated as she attempted to convey the cause of her affliction. I thought it was all because of eating meat, she said. I thought all I had to do was to stop eating meat, and then the faces wouldn't come back. But it didn't work. He knew he ought to concentrate on what she was saying, but he couldn't stop his eyes from gradually falling closed. And so, now I know. The face is inside my stomach. It rose up from inside my stomach. With her words sounding in his ears like a lullaby, one he could make neither head nor tail of, he plunged over the edge of consciousness and into a seemingly bottomless sleep. But I'm not scared anymore. There's nothing to be scared of now. When he woke up, she was still sleeping. The sunlight coming into the room was bright. Her disheveled hair wrapped her head like an animal's mane, while the crumpled sheet was coiled around her lower body. The smell of her body filled the room, a sour, tangy smell with notes of sweetness, bitterness, and a rank animal musk. What time was it? He fished his mobile out of the pocket of his sweater, which he'd hurriedly tossed aside the previous night. 1 in the afternoon. He'd fallen asleep sometime around 6 a.m., which meant he'd been sleeping like the dead for 7 straight hours. He pulled on his pants and trousers and looked around for his equipment. He packed up the tripod and lighting, but he couldn't see the camcorder anywhere. He remembered putting it down after he'd finished filming, right by the front door so it wouldn't get knocked over, but now it was nowhere to be seen. Could she have briefly woken up earlier and put it away somewhere? He went to take a look in the kitchen. Heading toward the sink behind the partition, he noticed something shiny that had fallen to the floor. It was the 6mm tape. Strange, he thought, then rubbed his eyes and took a proper look around him. There was a woman sitting with her face resting on the table. His wife. There was a wrapped lunchbox next to her elbow, and her limp fingers clutched her mobile. The camcorder was upside down underneath the table, its deck open. She must have heard him as he moved toward her, but she didn't stir. Darling, he said. His head was swimming. He couldn't believe this was happening. Only then did she lift her head from the table and stand up, but he quickly realized that she wasn't planning to come anywhere near him. Instead, she seemed to want to keep the table between them, to stop him from getting too close.
I hadn't heard anything from Youngye, so I thought I'd stop by on my way to the shop. I just happened to have made some seasoned vegetables, you see.
Her voice was incredibly tense. She was struggling to maintain her composure as though she were the one trying to justify herself. He knew that tone. It was the slow, low, faintly tremulous tone that meant she was fighting to conceal extreme emotion.
The door was open, so I came in. Then I saw that Youngye was all covered in paint, and I thought, that's strange. I didn't recognize you at first, because your face was turned to the wall, and your body was covered by the quilt.
Still clutching her mobile, she brushed her hair back from her face. Both her hands were shaking visibly.
I guessed Youngye had found a man, or maybe that she'd gone crazy for the second time, what with that stuff on her body. I knew I ought to just get out of there, but that man could have been anyone. And what if Youngye needed my protection? Then I spotted the camcorder by the door, and I picked it up and rewound the tape, just like you taught me ages ago. She was having to exercise extreme self-control,
squeezing out every ounce of her courage so that she could go on.
And I saw you on the tape.
In her eyes, there was a mixture of shock, fear, and despair that couldn't be expressed in words, whereas her facial expression looked almost callous. Only then did he realize that his naked body seemed to be actively disgusting her, and he hurriedly looked about for his shirt. He found it by the bathroom, tossed in a crumpled heap, and put it on.
"Darling, I can explain. It won't be easy for you to understand, but..."
She cut him off abruptly, raising her voice.
"I've called the emergency services."
"What?" He took a step toward her, incomprehension furrowing his brow. She backed away.
"You and Yonghye are both clearly in need of medical treatment."
Several seconds passed before he grasped that she was in earnest.
"What are you saying? That you're committing me to a mental hospital?"
Just then, a rustling sound came from over by the mattress. Both he and his wife held their breath. Yonghye pushed the sheet aside and stood up, stark naked. He saw that tears were streaming from his wife's eyes.
"Bastard," she muttered, swallowing her sobs. "Just look at her. She clearly isn't well. In her mind. How could you?"
Up until then, Yonghye had seemed oblivious to her sister's presence in the apartment. Only now did she look over at the two of them, her face a perfect blank. Her gaze was utterly devoid of any form of expression. She slowly turned her back on them and walked out onto the veranda. The chill air rushed into the apartment when she opened the sliding door. He fixed his eyes on the pale blue of her Mongolian mark, seeing the traces of his saliva and semen that had dried there like sap. Suddenly it felt to him that he had grown old, had experienced everything there was to experience, and that not even death held any fear for him anymore. She thrust her glittering golden breasts over the veranda railing. Her legs were covered with scattered orange petals, and she spread them wide as though she wanted to make love to the sunlight, to the wind. He heard the sounds of the approaching ambulance siren, of screams, sighs, the yells of children, all the commotion of the alleyway down below, the sound of feet hurrying up the stairs, coming closer. He had to rush out onto the veranda, now, and throw himself over the railing against which she was leaning. He would fall down 3 floors and smash his head to pieces. It was the only way. The only way to make a clean end of all of this. And yet, he kept on standing there, as if rooted to the spot, as if this were the final moment of his life, staring fixedly at the blazing flower that was her body, that body which now glittered with images so much more intense than those he had filmed during the night.
3. Flaming Trees.
She stands and looks out at the rain-swept road. She is at the bus stop across from the Masok terminal. Huge goods vans thunder past, speeding along in the fast lane. The raindrops drum against her umbrella, so forcefully it seems they might rip through the material. She isn't really young anymore, and it would be difficult to call her a beauty, exactly. The curve of her neck is quite attractive, and the look in her eyes is open and friendly. She wears light, natural-looking makeup, and her white blouse is neat, uncreased. Thanks to that smart impression, which one might reasonably expect to attract curiosity, attention is deflected away from the faint shadows clouding her face. Her eyes glimmer briefly. The bus she has been waiting for has appeared in the distance. She steps down into the road. She watches as the bus, which has been tearing along at a great pace, slows down.
"You're going to Choksong Psychiatric Hospital, right?"
The bus driver, in late middle age, nods to her and motions her up. She pays the fare, and as she scans the bus for somewhere to sit, her eyes pass over the faces of the other passengers. They are all watching her closely. Is she a patient, or is she a nurse? There doesn't seem to be anything odd about her. Well used to this, she keeps her eyes averted from those probing gazes, that mix of suspicion, caution, repugnance, and curiosity. She shakes the water off her folded umbrella. The floor of the bus is already wet, black and glistening. It wasn't the kind of rain for which an umbrella could provide sufficient shelter, and so her blouse and trousers are half-soaked. The bus picks up speed, racing along the wet road. She struggles to keep her balance as she walks down the aisle. Finding a double seat where both spaces are unoccupied, she takes the one next to the window. The windows have steamed up, so she gets a tissue out of her bag and wipes a patch clear. She watches the streaks of rain lashing the window with the untouched steadiness unique to those accustomed to solitude. As they reach Masok, the late June woods begin to unfurl on either side of the road. There's something battened down about the woods in this torrential rain, like a huge animal suppressing a roar. As it turns up the road to Choksung Mountain, the road gradually narrows and becomes winding, bringing the wet body of the woods undulating nearer. The base of that mountain over there, might those be the woods where, 3 months ago, her sister, Young-hye, had been found? One by one, the black spaces between the trees, concealed by the shaking canopy of rain-lashed leaves, pass in front of her eyes. She turns away from the window. The hospital staff told her that Young-hye had gone missing sometime during the hour that was set aside for the patients to take brief, unaccompanied walks, between 2 and 3 in the afternoon. This happened only on fixed days, only for non-serious patients, and only when the rain swelling the black clouds overhead seemed likely to stay there. Apparently, when the nurses had checked on the patients at 3, they'd been able to confirm that Young-hye hadn't come back. It was only then, they said, that the rain had finally begun to spit, just 1 or 2 drops at a time. The entire hospital staff were put on emergency. The management and staff hurriedly set up a roadblock on the corner where the buses and taxis went past. When a patient went missing, one possibility was that they had gone down from the mountains and already got as far as Masok, or the opposite possibility, that they had in fact gone deeper into the mountains. The rain had gradually grown heavier as the afternoon wore on. This was March, so when darkness fell, it did so very swiftly. It was extremely lucky that one of the nurses, who between them had fanned out and searched every inch of the neighboring mountain, did manage to find Young-hye. No, in fact it was nothing short of a miracle. That was what the doctor had said. Apparently, this nurse had stumbled upon Young-hye in an isolated spot deep in the woods, covering the mountain slope, standing there stock still and soaked with rain as if she herself were one of the glistening trees. When she'd got the call saying Young-hye had disappeared, which came around 4 in the afternoon, she'd been with her son Ji-woo, who was 6 years old. The boy had been running a temperature for several days at that point, and she'd taken him to have his lungs x-rayed. He was standing alone in front of the machine, glancing back and forth between her and the doctor, apprehensive.
Ms. Kim In-hye?
Speaking.
I'm Kim Young-hye's nurse.
This was the first time since Young-hye had been admitted that someone from the hospital had contacted her on her mobile. She herself called them only rarely, to check visiting times or occasionally to ask her sister whether everything was okay. In a composed tone of voice designed to conceal the urgency of the situation, the nurse informed her that Young-hye was missing.
We're doing all we can to find her, but if by chance she turns up at your home, you have to call us right away.
Before she hung up, the nurse asked,
Is there anywhere else she might possibly have gone? Perhaps to your parents? They live out in the countryside. I can contact them if you need me to.
She flipped the phone closed and put it in her bag, went into the x-ray room and hugged Ji-woo. He'd lost weight over the past few days, and his body felt light and hot in her arms.
I did really well, Mom.
Perhaps it was just because of the fever, but his face seemed flushed with the expectation of praise.
That's right. He really didn't move a muscle.
After the doctor told her she didn't think it was pneumonia, she hugged Ji-woo again, bundled him into a taxi, and was driven home in the rain. She hurriedly washed him, gave him rice porridge and medicine, and put him to bed early. There was no room in her thoughts for her missing sister. She hadn't been able to sleep properly for the 5 days her son had been ill, and that night, if the fever didn't abate, she would have to take him to be admitted to the general hospital. She was packing Ji-woo's clothes and making sure she had his medical insurance certificate, just in case the need did arise, when the phone rang again. This had been sometime around 9 in the evening.
We found her. Thank goodness. I'll come and visit next week as normal.
Her thanks were sincere, but subdued by fatigue. Only after she had hung up did it occur to her that the rain she had seen all day must have been pouring down on the mountain where Yongye had been found too. An indiscriminate connection, their existences briefly aligned. There was no way for her to judge the accuracy of the scene she saw then in her mind's eye, but had never seen in reality. She'd held a wet flannel to her snuffling son's forehead all night, slipping occasionally into a sleep that was more like fainting, and saw a tree flickering in the rain like the spirit of some dead person. Black rain, black woods, the pale patient's uniform soaked through. Wet hair. Black mountain slope. Yongye, an inchoate mass formed of darkness and water, standing tall like a ghost. Eventually, the day dawned, and when she placed the palm of her hand on her son's forehead, she was relieved by the coolness she felt there. She got up, went out of the bedroom, and stared blankly at the bluish half-light leaching in from the living room veranda. She curled up on the sofa and tried to sleep. She had to get some sleep before Jiwoo woke up, even if it was only an hour.
Look, sister, I'm doing a handstand. Leaves are growing out of my body. Roots are sprouting out of my hands. They delve down into the earth, endlessly, endlessly. Yes, I spread my legs because I wanted flowers to bloom from my crotch. I spread them wide.
Younghae's voice, which came to her while she was suspended in that halfway state between sleep and wakefulness, was low and warm at first, then innocent like that of a young child. But the last part was mangled, inaudible, a distorted animal sound. Her eyes snapped open in fright, and she was stung by a waking hatred the likes of which she'd never felt before being thrown back into sleep. This time she was standing in front of the bathroom mirror, in the reflection. Blood was trickling from her left eye. She quickly reached up to wipe the blood away, but somehow her reflection in the mirror didn't move an inch, only stood there, blood running from a staring eye. She swung herself up at the sound of Jiwoo's coughing and went into the bedroom. Yonghye had sat there hunched in a corner of the room a long time ago, but now she pushed that image from her mind and clasped her son's small hand, lifting it up as if playing a game.
It's okay now, she muttered,
but it wasn't clear who these words were intended to comfort, the boy or herself. The bus pulls over as it turns up the hill. She steps down and opens her umbrella. She's the only passenger alighting here. Without delay, the bus races off down the road. The narrow road splits here. One road goes up over the hill. You pass through a tunnel around 50 meters in length. When you emerge, the other side of the small hospital is visible, flanked by mountains on all sides. The rain is still pouring down, its measured cacophony slightly less vicious. She bends down. As she rolls up her trousers to keep them out of the wet, she notices the flaxleaf fleabane that has broken through the asphalt here and there. She adjusts her heavy bag, trying to ease her shoulders, puts up the umbrella, and starts walking toward the hospital. These days she goes every Wednesday to see how her sister is getting on, but before that rainy day when Yonghye went missing, once a month had seemed sufficient. She had walked this road carrying all manner of snacks, fruit, rice cakes, fried tofu stuffed with vinegared rice. It was desolate, with no sign of either vehicles or pedestrians. When she spread out the food on the table in the visiting room, Yonghye would silently go through the motions of chewing and swallowing, like a child diligently tackling homework. If she tucked Younghae's hair behind her ears, her sister would look up at her and smile quietly. These were the moments when there might have been nothing at all the matter, the moments that never failed to lighten her heart. Might it be okay, after all, for Yonghye to live like this indefinitely? Here, where she didn't have to speak if she didn't want to, didn't have to eat meat if the thought repulsed her. Couldn't the two of them get along just fine with these occasional visits? Yonghye was 4 years younger than her, enough of an age gap for them not to have been in competition with each other growing up. As small children, their young cheeks were frequently left throbbing by their heavy-handed father, and Younghye had provoked in Inhye a sense of responsibility that resembled maternal affection, a need to expend all her energy in looking out for this younger sister. She had watched, marveling, as this same sister, once up to her elbows in the dirt and suffering from a recurring heat rash on the backs of her knees, grew up and got married. The one thing that caused her distress was that as she got older, Younghye became more and more taciturn. She'd always had this side to her, of course, but she had also been perfectly cheerful and sociable when the occasion called for it. Somehow, not suddenly, but over a period of time, she became difficult to read. So difficult that there were times when she seemed like a total stranger. A day or two after Jiwoo was born, when Younghye came to the hospital to say hello to her first nephew, rather than congratulating her sister, she had simply muttered to herself, "I've never seen such a tiny child. So this is what they're like when they've just been born?" There'd been something faintly unsettling about the quiet smile playing around Younghye's mouth. What seemed to be happening was that Younghye was retreating from herself, becoming as distant to herself as she was to her sister, a forlorn face behind a mask of composure. This was clearly nothing like the melancholy that sometimes afflicted her husband, and yet in certain respects, they were both baffling to her in exactly the same way. They were both descending further into silence. She enters the tunnel. It's darker inside than usual on account of the weather. She closes her umbrella and walks. She listens to the ringing echoes of her footsteps. A large speckled moth, a type she's never seen before, flutters up off the surface of the wall into a darkness saturated with damp. She pauses for a while, looks up at its beating wings. But on the pitch-black tunnel ceiling, the moth stays put, as though conscious of being observed. Her husband liked to film flying things, birds, butterflies, airplanes, moths, flies. These scenes of flight, which he always seemed to have inserted into a piece despite an apparent lack of connection to the overall subject, had confused her. She was a layperson when it came to art. Once, she'd asked him why he'd included a particular scene, a 2-second clip of the black shadow of a bird soaring slowly up into the air, which he'd put after a scene of a ruined bridge and people crying at a funeral. "Just because," had been his answer. "I just ended up putting it in. I put it in and I thought it looked good." And then that familiar silence. Had she ever really understood her husband's true nature, bound up as it was with that seemingly impenetrable silence? She thought, at one time, that it might be revealed in his work, in his video art. In fact, before she met him, she hadn't even been aware that such a field of art existed. Despite her best efforts, though, his works proved incomprehensible to her. Nothing was revealed. She remembers the late afternoon when they first met. He'd come into her shop, skinny as a sorghum stalk, with several days' worth of stubble on his face, a camcorder bag slung over one shoulder that was clearly weighing him down. He searched out some shaving lotion, brought it to the counter, and rested both arms on the glass, looking utterly worn out. He looked like he might collapse and take the counter with him. It was faintly miraculous the way she, having had practically no romantic experiences up until then, came out with a friendly, "Have you had lunch?" As if surprised, but lacking the energy required to express that surprise, he had merely fixed her face with his exhausted gaze. Something in his defenseless state had drawn her to him. What she'd wanted from that afternoon had been to use her own strength to allow him to rest. But despite devoting herself wholeheartedly to this goal, even after they were married, he still looked perpetually worn out. He was always busy with his own things, and during what little time he did spend at home, he looked more like a traveler putting up there for a night than a man in his own home. His silence had the heavy mass of rock and the tenacious resistance of rubber, particularly when his art wasn't going well. It wasn't long before she realized something. Perhaps the one she'd so earnestly wanted to help was not him, but herself. Was it not perhaps her own image? She who had left home at 19 and gone on to make a life for herself and soul, always entirely under her own steam, that she had seen mirrored in this man's exhaustion? Just as she could not be certain of the source of her affection for him, or if he was really its true object, she had never been entirely sure of his feelings for her. He often seemed to rely on her, being the type for whom daily life was a constant struggle, full of potential pitfalls. He was honest to the point of seeming naive. Exaggeration or flattery was entirely beyond him. But to her, he was always kind, never once raised his voice in anger, and indeed would sometimes give her a look of great respect. "I don't deserve you," he used to say before they were married. "Your goodness, your stability, how calm you always are, the way you just get on with things and make it look so easy." Respect. That was what she'd taken his words to connote, but might they not in fact have been intended as a confession, that whatever it was he felt for her, it was nothing even remotely resembling love? Perhaps the only things he truly loved were his images, those he'd filmed, or then again perhaps only those he had yet to film. The first time she went to one of his exhibitions, after they were married, she was taken aback. She couldn't believe that this man, who had looked as though he might be about to collapse, had carted his camcorder around all these various places, with all the difficulties that must have involved. Indeed, it was hard for her even to imagine how he'd managed to negotiate to be allowed to film in sensitive places. The courage and sheer nerve he must at times have had to display, the patient perseverance that seemed so at odds with everything she knew about him. What it all came down to was that she just couldn't believe he'd been sufficiently passionate about the project to put himself through all that. There is one time that stuck in her memory. It had been a little after Jiwoo's first birthday, when the boy was just beginning to walk. Her husband had used his camcorder to film Jiwoo tottering around the sunny living room. He'd filmed Jiwoo suddenly being scooped up into her arms, her lips pressed to the crown of the boy's head. "Every time Jiwoo takes another step," he said, his eyes sparkling with life yet somehow inscrutable, "how about I make an animation so flowers spring up from his footsteps, like in that Hayao Miyazaki film? No, not flowers. Butterflies would be better. Ah, in that case, we should film it again, on a lawn." He showed her how to operate the camcorder, played back the scenes he just filmed, all while rattling on excitedly about his ideas for the piece. "You and he'll have to wear white clothes. No, wait. How about if the clothes were really shabby, old and worn? Yes, yes, of course, that's it. A poor mother and child on an outing. The multicolored butterflies that fly up like a miracle every time the baby takes an unsteady step." But they didn't have a lawn, plus Jiwoo soon grew out of the unsteady tottering phase. The video of butterflies flying up from the child's footsteps never became a reality. From a certain point onward, he began to work himself even harder than before. He shut himself up in the studio, not even coming home in the evenings or at weekends, and yet he never seemed to have anything to show for it. He wandered the streets until his sneakers turned black. Sometimes, when she woke in the early hours and went into the bathroom, she was startled to find him there, curled up in the empty bathtub, still in his clothes and sound asleep. After her husband left them, Jiwoo would often ask her, "Is there a dad in our family?" It was the question he'd asked her every morning, even when her husband was still around, so infrequently did the boy actually see him. "No," she would answer shortly, and then soundlessly, "no one at all. There's only you and me. That will have to be enough now." In the rain, the hospital buildings stand dreary and forlorn. Their gray concrete walls appear darker and more solid than usual. The wards on the first and third floors have iron bars over the windows. Many of the patients like to stick their faces between the bars. On bright days, it was difficult to make them out, but with a weather like this, several gray faces could be seen staring out at the rain. She glances up briefly to the windows of Younghae's third-floor ward annex, then walks inside and heads toward reception. "I've got an appointment to see Dr. Park In-ho." The receptionist greets her, recognizing her from previous visits. She closes her dripping umbrella and secures the tie around it, then sits down on a long wooden bench. While she waits for the doctor to come down from the consultation room, she turns to look at the Zelkova tree that stands in the hospital's front garden. The tree is clearly very old, easily 400 years. On bright days, it would spread its countless branches and let the sunlight scintillate its leaves, seemingly communicating something to her. Today, a day sodden and stupefied with rain, it is reticent and keeps its thoughts unspoken. The old bark on its lower part is dark as a drenched evening, and the leaves tremble silently on the twigs as the raindrops batter down on them. And she sees her sister's face, flickering like a ghostly afterimage overlaid on the silent scene. She closes her bloodshot eyes for a long time before opening them again. The tree fills her field of vision, still silent, keeping its own counsel. Still, she cannot sleep. It's been 3 months straight now, 3 months of getting by snatching pockets of sleep here and there, never more than an hour at any one time. Younghae's voice, the forest with the black rain falling, and her own face with the blood trickling from her eye, shiver the long night into fragments like potsherds. Usually, when she has given up on trying to wring any more sleep out of the night, it is around 3 in the morning. She washes her face, brushes her teeth, prepares some side dishes, cleans and tidies every corner of the house, and still the clock goes as slow as ever, the shifting of the hands like the almost comically suspended movements of some ponderous dance. In the end, she goes into his room and listens to some of the records he left behind, or puts her hand on her back and spins herself around the room as he once had, or curls up in the bathtub with her clothes on and even feels, for the first time, as though he mightn't have been so incomprehensible after all. He probably just hadn't had the energy to take his clothes off. Simple as that. He simply can't have had the energy to adjust the water temperature and take a shower. It struck her that this narrow, concave space was, oddly enough, cozier than anywhere else in the entire apartment. When did all of this begin? She sometimes asked herself in such moments. No, when did it all begin to fall apart? Younghae's increasingly odd behavior had become noticeable around 3 years ago, when she'd suddenly decided